In his 1994 article on Euthanasia, Historical, Ethical, and Empiric Perspectives, Ezekiel Emanuel lists a variety of traditional defenses and criticisms of euthanasia that date back to the 1860s and 1870s, and he suggests that these arguments and these theories, both in favor and against euthanasia, have remained fairly stable throughout that time. It's remarkable how, in his excellent recounting of these various arguments, Emanuel covers in detail the same issues which are raised very compassionately and from the perspective of the Catholic tradition in the 1980 Vatican Declaration on Euthanasia, which is the document to which we now turn. That document is the basis of all Catholic subsequent statements on euthanasia in virtually every papal and congregational statement concerning the subject of end of life and physician-assisted suicide. So it's important that we be aware of what it contains, since it provides this foundational basis for later discussion. If we could look first at the introduction. First, the document places itself in an historical perspective, reminding the reader that the Second Vatican Council had mentioned in a particular way crimes against life, including murder, genocide, abortion, euthanasia, or willful suicide. And it also points out that the recently, at that time, appearing document on abortion had addressed that particular aspect of these questions, and so it regards itself as appropriate in turning now to the question of euthanasia. And please notice in the passage that appears just before the pictures with the blue background, the passage beginning in modern society, that there is a specific mention of and an awareness throughout the document of the fact that modern medicine has, in the words of the document, increased its capacity to cure and prolong life in particular circumstances, which sometimes gives rise to moral problems. So the immediate background, which the pictures symbolize, of old age, of the existence of respirators and other medical technology that can prolong life, are precisely the issue that cause people to fear the process of dying now in a way that perhaps they did not to quite the same way, in the same extent in the past. And then in the highlighted passage under those pictures, people living in this situation experience anxiety about the meaning of advanced old age and death. And I'd like to highlight here the word meaning. In Latin, significatio extreme senectutis et mortis, the meaning or the significance of advanced old age and death. This really is going to be the central issue, that secular society does not find any meaning or value in advanced old age or in the dying process. And because of this, people drift into a mentality of denying the possibility of meaning, and then, as the statement goes on, begin to wonder whether they have the right to obtain for themselves or their fellow men an easy death, which would shorten suffering and which would seem to them more in harmony with human dignity. And again, I'd like to highlight the notion of dignity at this point. Because, as we shall see, although the issue of pain is significant, pain management, particularly in the United States, has become such an emphasis in the last decade and a half or two decades that palliative care teams are becoming much more common, much more widely available, and to some extent the issue of pain is not as primary as it once was. For many people, and as we'll see for most of those who try to argue in favor of euthanasia, the question they raise is one of dignity. So the Church is not unaware of this issue, but is concerned for the fact that it has, that the Church has a different approach to, a different understanding of both the meaning of advanced old age and the question of what human dignity consists in. And as we then look down at the next paragraphs, there is an acknowledgement that a number of episcopal conferences, that is, representatives of the local churches, have begun to speak about and address these questions, and that's part of the background to the reason for this document, that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith feels that it's appropriate for there to be a proper magisterial statement coming from the highest levels of church authority. And it's hoped, if you drop down to the last paragraph in this section that's highlighted in white, hope that people of goodwill who philosophical or ideological differences will nevertheless have a lively awareness of the rights of the human person. So it's hoped that there are some principles contained in this document that will be possible to acknowledge and to agree upon, even by those who do not share the faith perspective of Catholics or even of Christians. If we then look at section 1 on the value of human life, the Church will attempt to explicate what the particular value of human life is that Catholics extend, rather than just a philosophical notion of life having some sort of obscure but significant value. The statement is, human life is the basis of all goods, the necessary source and condition of every human activity, and then an acknowledgement that this is held by most people in most societies. Most people regard life as something sacred and hold that no one may dispose of it at will. But notice, and here this text I've highlighted in read, believers see in life something greater, a gift of God's love. Life is a gift, and this is a gift from God. And notice the interesting parallel that the Church has begun to highlight in documents ever since Humanae Vitae, that we then respond by making of ourselves a gift. Having first received the gift of life, we can then transform and make our lives into itself a gift. This is part of the meaning that Catholics understand life to hold. Believers see in life a gift of God's love, which they are called upon to preserve and make fruitful. So it isn't a question of ending if it suddenly seems to lack meaning, but to preserve, to hold as a gift, to protect, to regard as something precious given by God, and to make fruitful, to find meaning and value in life, even at its end, even when it appears to be without clear value or purpose, as society might understand that. So the preservation and making fruitful of life is important. It's not just a question of extending life in terms of temporal duration, in terms of time, but of perceiving and of appreciating at a deeper level the meaning and value that can only be perceived in a kind of a contemplative perspective, where one is attempting to see life as God's gift, that is, to look at life from God's perspective, or with human eyes that are able to see the meaning and purpose of God in ordinary human events. And then a series of principles that I have numbered 1-1, 1-2, and 1-3, although they do have some numbering in the original document. The first, no one can make an attempt on the life of an innocent person without opposing God's love for that person, and it is a crime of the utmost gravity. Any attempt to take the life of an innocent person is a crime of the utmost gravity. Everyone has a duty to live his or her life in accordance with God's plan. So our lives have a purpose and a value, and our discernment of that purpose and value is something that that is our project on earth. But not only there, going on, the life entrusted to the individual as a good must bear fruit here already on earth, but finds its full perfection, its final meaning and value only in eternal life. So there is an eschatological, a beyond this world quality to life that entails the meaning that Catholics will find in human existence. And then number 3, intentionally causing one's own death or suicide is therefore equally as wrong as murder. It's a rejection of God's sovereignty, and also, additionally, and I've indented this section and highlighted in yellow, a refusal of love for self. We are obliged to protect and care for the gift that God has given us of our own lives. Christ spoke of loving neighbor as self. We must love self, and it's also a denial of a natural instinct to live, that to take one's own life, even at the end of life, is to deny something that is a meaning already invested in life itself. And here's something that Catholics would emphasize, which our own very individualistic age would find deeply offensive and perplexing: a flight from the duties of justice and charity owed to one's neighbor, to various communities, or to the whole of society. So part of the evil of euthanasia is precisely that it causes a person to turn away from community, to deny that one's life has any meaning or value in that community, or that one continues to have any obligations in regard to community or society. And here is a point that will be stressed later in the document, that it is the presence of that community, the willingness of others to be present to someone who is suffering, who is experiencing limitation or meaninglessness in their life, that can answer precisely these kinds of objections and concerns. And then in this last paragraph of section 1, there is a distinction between suicide from sacrifice of one's own life for a higher cause, such as God's glory, salvation of souls, or service of brethren, referring particularly to the instance of martyrs who give their life for a higher cause. But notice that this is not a giving away, a throwing away of, a denial of the value of life, but engaging in an heroic act. And here, too, the principle of double effect would apply. One does not engage in martyrdom in order to die. If it were possible to avoid death, one would be morally obliged to do so. One engages in an act that is required or is itself of very great, and certainly in this case even of higher value than life, and not intending to take one's life or to end one's life, but recognizing that that will be or may well be the unintended consequence. And again, the thought experiment one can perform is, I'm going to engage in this heroic act, and if I were to survive, would that be okay too? If I didn't get to be a martyr, would the act still have value? So it's not the same thing. Suicide is not an heroic act. Suicide or euthanasia are not the same thing as giving one's life for a higher cause. Then in the first part of section 2, definitions of euthanasia. A distinction between an ancient or traditional understanding, the literal meaning of the word, or from the standpoint of etymology, euthanasia meaning an easy death, or even literally a good death, a death without severe suffering. And one is seldom, as the document points out, thinking this original meaning today, but rather using it in the context of medicine, of the practice of medicine, and as the text says, whereby the suffering of sickness or the final agony are reduced, sometimes also with the danger of suppressing life prematurely. So euthanasia directed primarily towards suffering or the pain of death itself. Then there's also an acknowledgement that the word has been used, particularly since the 1920s and 30s, and most notably and horribly in Nazi Germany, to refer to mercy killing, that is, putting an end to extreme suffering, or to those who are regarded as abnormal or unworthy of life, to the mentally ill or incurably sick, from the prolongation, perhaps for many years, of what is thought to be a miserable life. And we have seen, and this is still the case, that this is used as a rationale or justification, but it's not the primary focus of our study here. We're looking at the medical context of end of life and primarily of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia in that context. So therefore, in the final paragraphs of this section, the definitions that are employed here, by euthanasia is understood an action or omission which of itself or by intention causes death. So intentionality is absolutely fundamental, and the intention is to cause death so that suffering may be eliminated. This is how euthanasia is understood in this document, and indeed this is a very good definition for our own day. So, as it points out, euthanasia's terms of reference are to be found in the intention of the will and also in the methods used. What is the intention stated or hidden, covert, in the individual who is engaging in the act, and are the methods that they are using those to limit suffering or those to specifically end life? For example, if one is dealing with pain at the end of life, are the dosages of drugs that one is using appropriate to deal with pain, or are they such that they're going to suppress respiration intentionally and therefore cause death? Is one using such a large dose of medication that it's not even found in those dosages as acceptable for a person at that body weight? So both the intention of will and the actual fact of the method or the amount of medication used will indicate whether or not one is dealing with euthanasia or the treatment of suffering. And having made this definition, there is a reiteration, a restatement of the fact that nothing and no one can in any way permit the killing of an innocent person, whether fetus, embryo, infant, adult, or person, one suffering from an incurable disease, or a person who is dying. Killing any innocent individual is wrong. No one is permitted to ask for this act of killing, either for themselves or for another entrusted to their care, nor can they consent to it, either explicitly or implicitly. Nor can any authority legitimately recommend or permit such an action, for it is a question of the violation of divine law, an offense against the dignity of the human person, a crime against life, and an attack on humanity. a sweeping statement stating that there are no circumstances under which an individual can request euthanasia either for themselves or for another. And this is very important because, as we shall see, many requests for euthanasia are made by those who are acting on behalf of another person, not because they can actually experience or know what the person at that moment wants, but because of their own sense of what they think they would want if they were in that kind of a situation, a kind of projection which has really no value psychologically, spiritually, or from any other perspective, because it is projection by the healthy onto the sick of what they imagine the situation of the sick might be. But that's a question of motivation. This is simply a very clear statement of principle that it is absolutely wrong to request or to consent to this or to attempt to enforce it as an institution for any reason. The section marked in blue with white text, requests for euthanasia are often pleas for help, is my own commentary on this section, and I believe this paragraph is one of the most key observations which has been borne out in studies over the last 20 to 30 years. And the observation is that by reason of prolonged and barely tolerable pain, people believe that they can legitimately ask for death or obtain it for others. And the document acknowledges that these people are very often acting in good faith, but it points out that the pleas of gravely ill persons who sometimes ask for death are not to be understood as implying a true desire for euthanasia. And this is an important point. A person who asks for death is asking for something they have never in fact experienced. There really can't be an informed decision for death, since it represents an experience that no one has ever had, and therefore which cannot actually be described. One can only understand to a very limited extent its implications. So the conclusion here is, as the text that is boldface in black says, what a sick person needs besides medical care is love, that is to be surrounded by all those close to them, parents, children, doctors, and nurses. So if family is not available, healthcare personnel can take the place by acting in compassion, not abandoning, being present to the individual so that they know that they are not abandoned. This insight that requests for death are often requests for help is particularly true of people who are experiencing pain. As we've mentioned earlier in the course, if instead of killing the person, one finds out through careful questioning whether the person is in pain, and this would include psychological anguish or spiritual anguish as well, and then deals with that, the overwhelming majority of people stop asking to die. And one needs to add here that the question of pain also extends to the issue of meaninglessness. And it might be noted parenthetically that one is facing a rather uphill battle on this score, because one of the characteristics of postmodern society is the conviction that there is no real meaning in anything, and that meaning is something one imposes from within one's own psyche on external events, and therefore that events themselves only have meaning if one decides that they do. And so the individual who experiences life as meaningless is without any real place to turn from within the philosophical constructs of contemporary society. What the church is saying is that this lack, this gap, can be filled by community. If individuals are willing to act in compassion, not simply isolate, leave the person alone, presume that they can't hear or understand, but surround the person with acts of love and compassion, then what has formerly been experienced as meaningless can in fact be full of meaning, purpose, and a sense even of consecration of this end of life. And the next section, which I would invite you to read on your own, part 3, The Meaning of Suffering for Christians and the Use of Painkillers, emphasizes that once one is not simply trying to eliminate all consciousness, all awareness in treating pain, there is a value to the experiences that one has toward the end of life, or indeed in any kind of suffering in life, which is particularly characterized in Catholic tradition by an awareness that suffering has, as the highlighted text several paragraphs down just before the next blue section with the pictures states, suffering, especially suffering during the last moments of life, has a special place in God's saving plan. It is a sharing in Christ's passion passion and union with the redeeming sacrifice which he offered in obedience to the Father's will. This is a very beautiful and mystical insight, but it must not be pushed to dangerous and destructive extremes by individuals who decide that the end of life must be filled with experience of suffering so that the person can participate in Christ's passion. It happens naturally enough. One does not have to induce it by cutting back on the amount of pain medication that one uses, or by insisting that a person remain conscious even though consciousness for them is extremely painful. And that's particularly what this section is concerned with. And under the blue text with the pictures of the opium poppy, the first anesthetic surgery, and the ether inhaler, pictures we've already seen before, but reminders of the blessings that modern medicine provides, the Church points out in the first paragraph under these pictures, human and Christian prudence suggests that for the majority of sick people, the use of medicines capable of alleviating or suppressing their pain is appropriate. Even though it causes semi-consciousness and reduced lucidity, even though the person is less aware of their surroundings than they might otherwise be. Again, the Church provides for this in that the sacrament of anointing does not require that the person be fully conscious or even conscious at all. There is ministry to the sick and especially to the dying that does not require that the person be fully conscious and the possibility of commending that person into God's compassionate love. And in the section about three paragraphs down where Pius XII is quoted, this is a very essential reminder that suppression of pain and consciousness by the use of narcotics is permitted even if one is aware that they will shorten life. So the intention is to treat pain, the intention is not to shorten life, but by the principle of double effect, if the effect of shortening life takes place, then it is accepted. And the answer is yes. It is permissible. Death is in no way intended or sought. And as I've mentioned before, this is an absolutely central principle to hold on to, because the supporters of euthanasia will try to claim that philosophically there is no difference between giving a pain medication, knowing that it will shorten life, and doing so with the intention of shortening life. There is a denial of the significance of this principle of double effect, and as we'll see, that crops up periodically, and is an approach that has to be most vigorously refuted and denied in the Catholic context. We come now to a section that we've already seen and which we will highlight again in the next portion of this course, and that's the distinction between ordinary and extraordinary, or proportionate and disproportionate means, and the acknowledgement on the part of the Church that remedies are only to be administered that are necessary or useful. And one is not obliged to use all possible remedies. It is permitted to refuse treatments, especially for the reasons that we have already gone over, and which we will go over again, having to do with excessive pain. And pain can also be psychological, can be spiritual as well, a sense of extraordinary or unusual burden that the person is experiencing, or financial requirements of the treatment, which are more than the person chooses to expend. And there's a particular emphasis on and recommendation of the use of language of proportionate and disproportionate, rather than the older term extraordinary. Both imply an element of subjectivity, because what is disproportionate for one may not be for the other. One has to take into account the unique circumstances and subjective circumstances of the individual. And notice in about the fourth paragraph down, the lightly highlighted text, if there are no other sufficient remedies, it is permitted with the patient's consent to make use of experimental remedies, and it is permissible to interrupt these means when they fall short of expectation. It may be determined that the investment in instruments and personnel is disproportionate to the results foreseen. And it is permissible, and here we have a yellow highlighted text, to make do only with normal means, and one cannot impose on anyone the use of a technique which is in use, that is, might be considered from the availability or social or current practice of medicine standpoint, might be regarded as ordinary, but Number one carries a risk or is burdensome. One is not required to make use of remedies necessarily, and the refusal of such remedies, for the reasons we've mentioned, is not the equivalent of suicide. It is an acceptance of the human condition, a wish to avoid disproportionate care, or not to impose excessive expense. And this is an absolutely key paragraph, the section before the conclusion, when inevitable death is imminent. This is not defined, but it means nothing can prevent death, which is beginning to approach. It doesn't say it has to be a few hours or even a few days away, but death is imminent. Nothing is going to prevent it. It is permissible to refuse forms of treatment that would only secure a precarious and burdensome prolongation of life. So one is not obliged simply to prolong life if it is precarious, that is to say, tottering, that is the modalities that one is using are likely to shift the person over the edge, their absence is likely to make life extremely painful for the individual. In this case, one is not obliged to use anything that one experiences as burdensome or as inappropriate to maintaining a comfortable life. And this would extend, in the case of the dying, even to nutrition and hydration, as we shall see in the next section of the course. Certainly, the people who are experts in palliative care point out that once one has reached truly the last stages of life, one is entering the dying trajectory and organ systems are beginning to shut down. Nutrition and hydration do not, in fact, enable the person to experience life in any more positive way, and attempts to provide them can sometimes, in fact, result in very unpleasant side effects for the individual, such as diarrhea if NG tube feedings are continued past the point where the person can continue to absorb food. So, especially as death is imminent, people are not obliged to do anything they don't want to do, to have anything that they do not experience as helpful for them. And this magnificent observation in the conclusion that we should, without in any way hastening the hour of death, be able to accept it with full responsibility and dignity. Responsibilitas and dignitas. These are vital words because the notion of dignity is precisely one which is employed by the advocates of euthanasia. They point out that they want death with dignity. The Church believes that part of the dignity and the responsibility we possess is because of the fact that death opens the door to eternal or immortal life. So it's this eschatological, this presence of heaven dimension to our existence that allows us to believe that the end of life has a particular value and that significantly colors and characterizes our approach to individuals who are suffering at the end of life, and that dignity does not mean ending life, but enabling it to be clearly seen that this person is moving even closer towards God and that this stage of life is particularly consecrated and particularly holy.